Okay, folks, it is 7 o'clock. We're going to dive into cover 1st and 2nd Kings tonight. How'd you cope with last week? We talked about the judges in a way that might have been different from how you learned about Gideon and Samson and Deborah in Sunday school. We talked about using the superhero genre to argue that human strength is not going to save anybody. That's essentially the message, I think, of the book of Judges. And then we talked about how God gave them human leaders because they could cope without. But once the leaders got power, they couldn't cope. We saw that with Saul, who lost the kingship, and then with David, who was fine until he actually had power and then started using that to benefit himself again. That's what we talked about last week. We're going to continue that theme today as we look at Solomon and then the following descendants of King David in the time of the kings. 1st and 2nd Chronicles actually repeats much of the stuff that's in 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings. So we're not going to spend a lot of time in Chronicles. A couple of times we'll notice where it's telling it from a different perspective. If you really want to look at the difference between the two tellings of the story, Chronicles is written after they came back from exile and settled into the land when there's no kingdom anymore. So Chronicles tends to tell a rather idealized version of the story of David's kingship, Solomon's kingship, because they're just longing for the kingship to be restored. And you can clearly see the difference in the final chapter of the two books. The final chapter of 2 Kings tells the story of how Babylon comes in and destroys Jerusalem, and it's just the worst thing that ever happened. And city's on fire, everybody's in trouble, and you can feel the emotional pain because it's so present. Whereas in Chronicles, it's after they've come back from exile and they're rebuilding. So it actually tells the story, but without the same emotional involvement, more with a sense of, we think the story is not over yet. So just a different angle, so similar content. So we're not going to spend a lot of time in Chronicles. We're going to concentrate mostly on Kings tonight. We probably have a few history buffs in the room. If you have studied any ancient history or even modern history, it tends to be about the kings. History is written about the Caesars of Rome or the pharaohs of Egypt or whoever the kings are. And so if you're a history buff, this will kind of be fairly obvious stuff to you. If you're not really into history, then reading a list of kings can feel, what's the point of all this stuff? So I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through the list of the kings tonight. I do actually have a couple of books that have the stories of the kings, and I'll just pass those around for the history buffs to have a look at.
Thank you.
There are, in fact, 19 kings of Israel, 19 kings of Judah, and each of them gets one page in this book. So you can just have a look and pass it around or have a look in more detail at supper time if you'd like to do that. We'll start with Solomon. Solomon is the next king after David. And what Kings does is to trace how the kingdom begins to fall apart from the death of Solomon until there's nothing left. So once again, it's not really an encouraging trajectory, but there's some crucial stuff for us to learn and understand and see how this stuff develops. Solomon starts out really well. Have you ever heard of the wisdom of Solomon? When Solomon began, he prays, "O Lord God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David. But I am only a little child and I do not know how to carry out my duties." Remember how we talked about David being the under shepherd? The Lord is my shepherd. I'm not the top dog here. That's essentially what Solomon is saying in this. God, you've appointed me to this task, but because I'm just a little servant, I have no idea how to do this task really well. Your emphasis on servant is here among the people you have chosen. So not a big emphasis on you've chosen me. These are your people. You've chosen them and I've got the responsibility. Help! So this beautiful dependence on God. And so what he asks God for is a discerning heart to govern your people, to be able to distinguish between right and wrong. Who's able to do this stuff? So there's this calling on God, this asking for God, not grasping for power, but dependency on God. Dependency on God is a really good definition of faith, because faith is the operative self-dependence. So Solomon starts out with this beautiful faith that's depending on God. Asking for help to wait wise judgments. you know why he was making judgments, don't you? People would bring him cases, justice cases, and say, okay, so this guy stole my sheep. This two women who both claim to be mothers of the same baby, and how do you solve all this stuff? And so Solomon asks for wisdom to be able to judge those sorts of cases. And he provides the kingdom with structure, with stability, with security, and with provision. That's essentially chapter 4 of 1 Kings. And then Solomon focuses the whole nation on honoring God as the true king over everybody. Remember how David wanted to build a house for God? And God said, your son is the guy who's to do this. So Solomon does all of the work to construct a house for God in Jerusalem. Previously, the Ark of God, the throne that Israel gave to their king, was in a tent way up in Shiloh. David brought it into Jerusalem. Solomon builds a permanent house for the permanent sovereign, honors God, leads the people in honoring God. So these early chapters of 1 Kings are literally amazing with his faith, his dependence on God, his request for God's wisdom to look after God's people, and his honoring of God. It took him 7 years to build the temple. Now that's a long time. So if you can imagine 7 years of construction for the house of God, and there's actually an enormous amount of work that goes into that, and Solomon spares no expense. He is importing cedar from Lebanon and gold from other places. And where do you think the money for that comes from? Solomon doesn't have unlimited wealth for himself, right? This is actually coming from the people, because he's king and he's asked for it, and he has the right to ask for it, and he's asking for it so he can build God's house. But on top of what he's spending, there's also a lot of labor involved in construct the house. And so this is how 1 Kings describes how that labor worked. King Solomon conscripted laborers from all Israel, 30,000 builders. They're all serving Solomon for 4 months out of the year for 7 years. Now, that's pretty intense, right? If you have ever run a business of your own, could you imagine having no business opportunities because you've had to leave everything and all of your workers have had to leave the stuff too, so you can go and work in the temple for 4 months of the year? So you've got to make enough in 8 months to make the business survive. If it's just a family business on a farm, then you're off helping to build a temple for the Lord. This is pretty intense stuff. And it certainly takes its toll on the people. So when the 7 years are up, these guys are feeling like, right, we finally can get back to business and start earning our income again. But it actually doesn't work like that. So after Solomon had spent 7 years building the temple, remember there's no chapter breaks in the Hebrew text, it took Solomon another 13 years to complete the construction of his own palace. So once he's got everybody working for him like this, and he's charging this kind of taxation on the people, Solomon can't let go. He can't relinquish having that kind of power over people's lives, and he sets them all to work now to build his own palace for himself for twice as long as it took to build a house for God. Something's gone wrong here. Solomon has begun to use his position of power for himself. Isn't this what Samuel told him? If you have a king, he will take, and here it is. Solomon is taking from the people again and again and again, and this literally goes on for 20 years. At the end of this 20 years, it's approaching the end of Solomon's reign. And the people are done. They're sick of being conscripted and effectively enslaved for a significant part of the year, not only to build a house for the heavenly king, but to build a house for their earthly king for twice as long. So even though Solomon started out so well, he ends up abusing the power that's trusted to him to feather his own nest. I mean, quite literally, to build a house for himself. Solomon is able to hold it together until he dies. But when he dies, the people are so sick of this that they come to his son and say, this can't go on. We are not prepared for this to continue. So I'm jumping to chapter 12 now of 1 Kings. I'd like you to notice what happened. This is actually in your notes on page 38. I'm just going to read a few verses from quite a long passage here. They come to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, the son of David. They say to him, your father Solomon put a heavy yoke on it. We feel like we're actually like bullocks being locked up, enslaved here. Now, please, would you lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us? If you do that, we'll be happy to serve you. In verse 13, the king answered the people harshly. He said, my father made your yoke heavy. I will make it heavier. I mean, he doesn't even have a few good years where he's a gentle, submissive king seeking to serve God. From the very outset, he says, no, I'm not backing off at anything. You are under my power. He's already corrupted by power. Even at the beginning of his reign, it's going bad. My father made your yoke heavy. I'll make it heavy. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. This is worse than Pharaoh. This is an enslavement to a human king that's worse than what God's supposed to save them from in the first place. And so in verse 16, when all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they said to the king, what share do we have with David? What part do we have in Jesse's son? To your tents, Israel. Look after yourself, house of David. David came from the tribe of Judah. All the rest of the tribes refused to serve Solomon's son, Rehoboam. They created a nation of their own. So from 1 Kings 12 onwards, where you read the term Israel, it no longer refers to the whole nation. From this chapter on, the term Israel refers to the northern nations who have their own king and are no longer serving the son of David. And only the tribe of Judah in the south is still serving David, still has Jerusalem as their own capital. So 1 Kings 12 is a watershed in the Bible text. You need to know that from this point onwards, there are two separate kingdoms. There are two separate kings. A guy named Jeroboam becomes king of the northern kingdom, Israel, all the other tribes. And David's descendants continue to rule in Judah. There are two separate capitals. The capital of Israel from this moment on is a town called Samaria, whereas the capital of Judah is still Jerusalem, because David's son is ruling in the town that David made the capital. Now, it's not quite as cut and dried as one tribe against all the others. The little tribe of Benjamin, which is kind of in the middle between the two, joins in with Judah. So it's actually two tribes against 10. If you remember, the land of Simeon was part of Judah as well. So kind of Simeon's in here as well. And the Levites didn't get land. So some of the Levites are living in Judah and some of them are living in Israel. And so there's kind of a split tribe. It's not quite as cut and dry as one tribe against all the others. But if you think of Judah as David's tribe with David's king in the capital that David set up, Jerusalem, and the other tribes as Israel with a separate king in a separate place, a separate capital, a separate government, and separate worship, you'll understand what's going on. So that's the split point where the nation, the kingdom, has begun to fall apart. So it literally begins to fall apart at Solomon's death. Because it's two separate nations, these nations are more vulnerable to being attacked by enemies. They're weaker. Not only that, but there are times when they're fighting each other. They're helping to destroy each other. So once again, the tribes are fighting and harming each other instead of banding together as the people of God. It's devastating. And it quite literally is the beginning of the end. They never actually recover from this division. Is this familiar territory? You're used to the idea of a divided kingdom? Yeah. 1 Kings 12 is the place where it all starts to fall apart. Now, this map is in your notes. I hope it helps, but just think of Israel as the Northern Confederacy, the Northern Kingdom, and Judah as the Southern Kingdom. All the rest of 1st and 2nd Kings, you're going to be switching backwards and forwards between who was king in the north and who was king in the south. I'm not going to follow that tonight because it's like it takes too long to go through that. I'm just going to take you quickly through what happened to Israel, the northern part, and their history, and then we'll come back and we'll have a look at what happens with Judah, the southern part. What happens with Israel, the north? Well, they do not want their people going down to Jerusalem because Jerusalem's not part of their territory. So they don't want worship happening in Jerusalem. So they figure out that they should set up their own worship centers. So they don't want people going to the temple. And so they place two worship centers in their own nation. One at a place called Dan, which is in the very, very north, the little red dot at the top. And the other one at a place called Bethel, which is on the border with Judah. So no matter how far, anywhere you lived, you would have a worship center close to you, but nobody needs to go past the southern one to get to Jerusalem. Like those are the two places that are worship centers for Israel. Unfortunately, these people are not serving the Lord. So they set up at the heart of their worship center a statue for people to worship, a golden calf, because that's part of Israel's story, isn't it? So in your notes, there's a little picture of the site in the north where the golden calf used to be. It's not still there, but where that metal frame is the location of the altar and the base that the golden calf would have stood on. You can visit those sites today. All 19 kings of Israel are evil kings. Now, when I say kings of Israel, talking about the divided kingdom, not talking about Judah, talking about the north. All 19 kings are regarded in 1st and 2nd Kings as being evil kings. And the reason is that they are walking in the sins of Jeroboam. Who was Jeroboam? He was their first king. Jeroboam was the one who led these tribes out from under the Davidic kingship. So they weren't under the king who was appointed by God. And he's the guy who set up the golden calves so the people are worshipping golden calves instead of worshipping God. So directly, they've rejected God, and indirectly, they've rejected God's anointed. Rejecting the Lord and his anointed are the sins of Jeroboam. And you read that phrase again and again and again about effectively all of the kings of the north. That's what was wrong with them. They directly and indirectly rejected God's authority, set up their own instead, which effectively makes them just like one of the nations of the world. They're not serving the Lord. So what does God do with this? God doesn't just walk away. I just love the patience and the faithfulness of God in Scripture. God doesn't just walk away and say, well, stuff you mob, you don't want me around, I'm out of here, right? I mean, that's not what he does. What he does is send them a messenger to call them back. Say, will you come back to me again? And the messenger's name is Elijah. Elijah the prophet, the one who brings the word of the Lord, the messenger who's calling Israel, the northern kingdom, to come back to God, to submit to God's authority, to worship God, to come under the Davidic kingship, to recognize the Lord rather than the other gods as their God. Now, you may have heard the story about Elijah and the contest on Mount Carmel. Is that familiar territory to you? Elijah decides he's going to have to convince these people who their God is. I'll give you a little bit of background about Canaanite religion so you can understand why he did this. According to the Canaanites, there's lots of gods. In fact, there's one god over this area, another god over this mob, and these people over here have their own god. Everybody's got their own gods, and we're all happy. You'll find that again and again throughout the Old Testament, that the Canaanite god who is named Baal simply means lord or master, and each place has their own Baal. So there's the Baal of Peor, and there's the Baal of these people, and the Baal of everyone has their own gods. And this god, Baal, is the one that they wanted to worship because he was the storm god. So he was like Thor throwing his hammer around the heavens, making all the thunder and the lightning and the storms that brought the rain. So if you're a farmer, he's probably your favorite god. Whichever's the Baal over your area, that's the one that you want to serve, so that your crops will grow and it'll make your herds fertile and it'll all be great. There was another Canaanite god called Mot, M-O-T. Mot was the god of death or dearth. Some years, the contest between the gods, Baal would win and the rains would come and everything would be great. Other years, Mot would win. And you'd see the grain in the ground just turning brown and dying off before it ever got the harvest because Mot was in power. And so what the Canaanites wanted to do was to feed Baal, make him big and strong and fat so he could beat Mot for them. And so the whole Canaanite religion was about this whole thing of worshipping the storm god so he could bring the rains and their lives would be rich and prosperous and life would be good and alive and fertile and virile. Baal was supposed to do all that stuff. So Elijah comes to the king of Israel, a guy named Ahab, and says to him, you need to quit serving the Baals and you need to turn back to serving the God of the covenant who defined all 12 tribes as his people. You need to recognize the Lord as your God. And because you won't, I'm going to demonstrate to all the people of Israel that it is Yahweh, the Lord, who provides for his people, who is the God of Israel, that you're actually worshipping the wrong gods and you're wasting all of the energy trying to make Baal fat so he can. It doesn't work like that. So as God's spokesman, I am telling you today, Ahab, there will be no rain in Israel until I, God's spokesman, announce it. That's not exactly the way to win a popularity contest with the king of Israel. Elijah has to run for his life. And of course, there's no rain. And in a society that is totally dependent on agriculture for their survival, people begin to die. Second year and the third year, and it's crippling the nation. And King Ahab and his leadership is pretty much in trouble now because people have heard the story. They know. So Elijah comes back, which is a pretty scary thing to do when you've brought the nation to its knees, says to Ahab, now is the time for a contest. I want you to get all the prophets of Baal, will climb up on the mountain and they can call for the rain god to bring his rain and prove that he is the God of Israel. And if they don't succeed, I will call to Yahweh and prove to you that it is he who is the God of Israel. So you know the story? Yep. All day long, prophets of Baal screaming, trying to get Baal's attention. He's not answering. There's no thunders flying around the heavens. There's not a cloud in the sky. It's just totally blue sky. Nothing's happening. Elijah is poking fun at these prophets saying, oh, I wonder where your God's gone. He doesn't seem to be our God. This is just making fun of the whole thing. And then in the evening, about the time when the sacrifice to Yahweh was due to be offered, Elijah says, flood my altar here with water, will you? So there's no trickery in this place. And I'll begin to call on the name of the Lord. He calls, there's a lightning blast or something, and fire comes down from heaven, falls on this, burns up the burnt sacrifice that was being offered by Elijah for Israel to the Lord at the evening sacrifice times, burns up the altar, burns up all the water that's there. And people are freaking out when they watch what's going on. And the people begin to cry, Yahweh, he is God. This is the God who answered. We don't belong to, they're foreign gods. The Baals do not reign over us. The Lord, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. He's demonstrated who is the God of Israel. So now we can finally have the division healed between the two, the Davidic kingship restored, the Lord reigning over. Doesn't work like that. Even though he's demonstrated who is the God of Israel, the people of Israel do not continue to serve God because the king of Israel is not willing to yield his power. And neither is his wife, actually. Jezebel, who is actually a foreigner and believes in a whole lot of other foreign gods, views Elijah as a threat to their authority. And she wants him out of the way. And it burns Elijah out. So really from this moment on, Elijah's just a burnt out prophet who's too scared to listen to God or hear God's word anymore. So God still cares for Elijah, but it hasn't actually worked. Eventually, Elijah is out of the picture. And in his place, God sends another prophet with a very similar name. He was? Elisha. So in the latter part of 1 Kings, Elijah is the spokesman for God to the kings of Israel. And then as you move into 2 Kings, for the first 13 chapters, Elisha is the follow-up prophet who keeps on demonstrating to the people that Yahweh is God. You, as the nation of Israel, belong under God by the Sinai covenant. He is your king. He is your, you need to return to the Lord. But they don't. They can't let go of their power. And so Israel continues in the sins of Jeroboam, not serving God, not serving God's anointed king. Until a huge power to the north starts marching its armies around the other nations. We're talking about a kingdom called Assyria. If you studied any ancient history from this region, you will be aware of Assyria. In the 700s, 800s BC, it's the biggest power in the area. Can you see how much of a shadow is on the map all the way from the Persian Gulf right up through Armenia, cross into Turkey, all the way down into Egypt? That's the extent of the Assyrian Empire. And do you notice that it includes this space? So the Assyrian king sends his army, besieges the capital of Israel, which is not Jerusalem, it's Samaria. And after a three-year siege, Samaria is unable to hold out, and Assyria owns Israel. The northern kingdom is now gone permanently from the nation of God. 722 BC. So from 1 Kings 12, Solomon's death, Rehoboam, until 2 Kings 17, when Assyria invades, that's how long it's a divided kingdom. After 2 Kings 17, all we have left is Judah. And that lasts for about another 135 years. Judah, on its own, survives a bit longer. Are you interested to know how Judah came to survive when this huge shadow covers everything? The armies of Assyria literally did come all the way through Judah, and they besieged Jerusalem as well as they had besieged Samaria. The king in Jerusalem, the descendant of King David who's ruling over Judah, is a guy named Hezekiah. Hezekiah has this realization that he's got no chance against this enormous Assyrian army, a power that just dwarfs his little tiny fraction of a nation. And he goes to Isaiah the prophet. Hezekiah says, freak out time, mate. What on earth are we going to do now? He brings a letter where he's been asked to surrender and lays it out in the temple space with Isaiah the prophet. Isaiah prays for him and tells him, God is going to give you victory despite the David and Goliath struggle that's going on between the little tiny Judah and the huge Assyria. Hezekiah trusts God with that. What happens is that God moves and some kind of plague of some kind breaks out amongst the Assyrian soldiers in their camp, and an enormous number of soldiers actually die. So the commander of the army realizes he's in serious trouble, and he withdraws his troops and goes back to Assyria. And Assyria never actually recovered from that enormous loss that they suffered then. Assyria eventually gets taken over by Babylon, but they are no longer a threat. So Hezekiah's faith, his trust in God, was what rescued him despite ridiculous odds against it. Just an amazing story in the middle of all of this struggle. All right, anything else on 1 Kings?
Helen, wasn't Jeroboam given the 10 tribes? He was actually, when he escaped into Egypt, there was a prophet that told him that he would get the 10 tribes, isn't he?
Indeed, there was. You're exactly right. I've simplified the story a little bit because we have to be able to get through this in a time. But there was indeed a prophet. Now, there's a complicated relationship here between kings and prophets. No one could become king unless the gods decreed it. So for Jeroboam to actually become king of Israel, the north, it had to be decreed by God. And he did find a prophet who was prepared to say to him, because of the abusive heart of Solomon, I am tearing away 10 tribes from Judah. I'm not tearing the whole thing away from it. His son will continue I promised it to David, but God is tearing this away and giving it to you. So he did find a prophet who was actually prepared to say that. So once again, this is the way that Hebrew scriptures work. Anything that happens has to be God or it couldn't happen. Right? If the Assyrians invade, it had to be because God brought them. If the Babylonians invade, if the kingdom split, it had to be because God decreed it. Anything that happened had to be what God decreed. But at the same time, they can say, but actually the sins of Jeroboam, by taking the kingship of the north and then not allowing God's anointed, and by setting the people up to serve foreign gods, the sins of Jeroboam is the thing that prevented these people from ever returning to God. So it has it both ways, because ultimately God's in charge of both sides of the story, everything. That's the way it's presented. Good point. Yeah, there's a lot more to the story than what we've summarized. So you're comfortable with this idea of two separate nations, Israel versus Judah. Two sets of kings, two capitals, two different groups of people, two nations. And by 2 Kings 17, the top one is gone. It is actually really devastating when it happens. It's just totally destructive. I should read you a little piece from 2 Kings 17 where it happens, and then we'll take our break. The king of Assyria invaded the entire land. This is the land of Israel. Well, he invaded Judah as well, I suppose, but he didn't get to take that bit. He marched against Samaria. He laid siege to it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, if those books are making its way around, Hoshea is the last of the kings of Israel. They list the kings of Israel first and the kings of Judah towards the end. In the 9th year of the last king, Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. So they went into exile. And then he goes on to describe how the Lord was very angry with Israel. We're talking about the north. Verse 18, and he removed them from his presence. There's a picture of a great heavenly sovereign who is so fed up with how these people are treating him, worshipping other gods, wanting to be under other leaders, that God says, close the door, send them out. They want to be under other leaders? I'll give them to other leaders if they won't serve me. Verse 22, the Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until the Lord removed them from his presence as he had warned through his servants, the prophets. So the people of Israel, northern kingdom, were taken from their homeland into exile in Assyria. And at the time when this was written down, they'd never come back. After Judah goes into exile to Babylon, there are some who return. But effectively, those who were taken into exile from the northern kingdom in the time of Assyria did not resettle. So who was living in this space afterwards? Well, verse 24, the king of Assyria brought people from a whole bunch of other places and settled them in the towns of Samaria to replace the Israelites. So the people who lived in Samaria and the surrounding towns after this weren't even properly descended from Abraham. I mean, some of them probably still had a little bit of that blood in them, but by and large, they were actually foreigners that were living in the land here around Samaria. Can you understand why in the New Testament times the Jewish people had nothing to do with the Samaritans? They weren't proper descendants of Abraham at all. They're from all these other places that have been settled in there to replace the Israelites. They took over Samaria and lived in its towns. That's the end of Israel. all the tribes gone except for Judah, which is the little remnant that's left, and the other tribes are gone. So we'll take a coffee break and we'll come back to talk about what happened to Judah and what happens after this.